So, is the volume appropriate for you? Everybody can hear okay? Okay. So, we're coming to the end of the retreat, and in life we regularly come to the end of things. And there's a variety of opportunities with the ending of things. Sometimes endings are seen or associated with loss. Something ends, and it's unfortunate they end, and the association very much for people is the losing of things, things coming to an end. Endings also associated with gain. What was uncomfortable is now going to stop. The end of the sittings finally come. Thank God for endings. And the possibility of what's going to come. Lunch. So I'm so glad these endings can happen so we can go to lunch. So endings are what ends and what's lost, what's left behind, which can be sad and can be happy to have that ending. And there's endings have to do with what's gained and what's comes. And then kind of in between those two, or separate from those, is the very fact of ending leaves, for the moment of ending, before the next thing begins, there's a kind of a moment or instant of absence. Or in the process of something ending and going, there can be kind of an absence there. And that absence for some people can seem bleak, can seem, you know, unfortunate. But there's also an opportunity for discovering a profound kind of peace, a profound kind of freedom that is not really possible if we're always involved with what we're leaving behind, what's going, or what's coming, what's going to arise. So it's that space between the comings and going, or the place before, you know, when something ends before something else begins, kind of points to a possibility of freedom that Buddhist practice is also pointing to. I'll try to speak about some of that today. So I want to read first a story from this book, A Monastery Within. The abbess once said, "If a person is always surrounded by music, she may never imagine there is an alternative. But if, after many years, she comes to a place where there is no music, she may be surprised, maybe even shocked, by the relief of not hearing the constant sound. If her experience of silence makes a strong enough impression, then when she returns to the world of music, she will not only hear the music, but also the silence which is always here with the music. With awakening," she said, "you will know a peace which is always here." So there's certainly a lot of lack of peace in this world. It's easy to point to, easy to be preoccupied with. A lot of agitation in one's own mind, agitation and challenges in the world around us. And some people, that's all they know their whole life, is to be involved and think about themselves, others, the things of the world, the activities of the world, what's going on. People who, for example, have never been safe, may constantly be looking into the world to where can they find the safety? Where is the danger? And they're always kind of looking at something. And because of that, they might not discover that there is a certain kind of safety to be found by no longer looking and relating and actively engaged in, you know, looking for safety, looking for danger, just letting that all drop. So for example, someone can live that way all the time, and they might come on retreat. And I know many years ago at Spirit Rock, someone came to retreat there. And she said that in all her life, Being at Spirit Rock, walking the land there, was the first time in her life she ever felt safe. That's an amazing thing. But to come on retreat, and perhaps for a few moments, to put down some of the preoccupations we have. So someone who's always afraid and always looking and trying to look for safety and security or avoiding danger, and maybe they come on retreat and for a few moments their mind quiets down and settled and they're not doing that activity. And for the first time in their life, then they see, wow, I didn't realize how I was always operating on fear. I had no idea it was so constant for me, because now I've seen the moment without it. And that moment of the absence of fear becomes very, very potent, very powerful. It's an absence which is not dull, is not boring, it's an absence which is not nothing. You don't want to say that, you go to the teacher and say, I had this absence of fear, first time in my life. I had no idea it was possible to be without fear. And the teacher says, oh, just an absence, absence don't count. you have to, get somewhere and get on with life. Picks things up quickly or something. No, it's an absence. Hopefully the teacher says, great. It's an absence which counts. It's an absence which is something, but you can't call it a thing because it's an absence, right? But the contrast of where we came from is so huge that maybe the person will never forget the moment they had that absence of fear. It might be life-changing for them. Oh, I know that this is possible. This is great. And so the movement of Buddhist practice is learning to put down, let go, stop a certain activity that we've always been doing long enough that we see that there's an alternative, there's another way of being. And in seeing that other way of being, we might go back to what we were doing before, or some of what we were doing before, but the music is there, we go back to. We're always aware there's the silence that's there with the music. Without silence, there would be no music that we would enjoy between the beats and the notes. And so so here's another story that also points to, an alternative way of once teaching the monastics. The abbess told this story. There was a species of humans born in the ocean. They were born being able to swim, and all their life they swam. After many years of constantly swimming, one man started to get tired. He heard that if he swam far enough to the east, he would find a resting place that was free of the ocean. After swimming east for many, many years and not finding the resting place, someone told him of a rumor of such a place in the south. He swam south for many more years, but never found that place. Similarly, he swam to the north and to the west, but nowhere could he find the mythic place where there was final, ultimate rest. Bone weary from his endless swimming, he came across a woman who laughed at his quest. The rest you seek is not found anywhere else but where you are. All you have to do is turn over on your back and float. Monks and nons, the abbess continues. Monks and nuns, desires are endless. You won't get to the end of desire by desiring. What you seek is not found through seeking. When you can let go fully and simply float, what you seek is right there. So its story also points to the idea that it can be a constant maybe incessant way of being in the world that we have, constantly thinking about things, planning, trying to create a better past if we just think it out enough times, trying to figure out our, you know, the solutions to all our resentments, trying to make ourselves safe, trying to imagine all the things we want and the desires and try to get them. And some people go from one mental activity to the next where their mind is always concerned about something. So most thoughts that we have are about something. If you speak in English, we usually think in, you know, subject, verb, and object, something like that, you know, so we have these different things. So there's something it's about. I'm thinking about the lunch. I'm thinking about supper. I'm thinking about, you know, how long is Gil going to talk today? I'm thinking about my knees. I'm thinking about, you know, how's my meditation going? Is it what it's supposed to be? And reminds me I have an interview with a teacher, and what should I say? And, you know, it's, it goes on and on and on. The about, we live in an about world. And that about world can be a kind of, sometimes, a very much a virtual reality. And some people live in that world, you know, pretty constantly without knowing it. Luckily, reality bumps into us. So it's hard to get completely lost in it. But, you know, sometimes meditation is a great place to get lost because there's not enough reality bumping into us. We sit down and close our eyes, and there's some great fantasies to have while you meditate. And I've known people, and I know myself, I once had a fantasy on a 3-month retreat that lasted 3 days. That is, you know, maybe a bit excessive. But I couldn't stop it. I tried. I just couldn't stop it. So this world of aboutness, and it's sometimes inconceivable for our mind to imagine a way of being, operating, that's not about something, not concerned with something. But we can turn over and rest, turn over in a radical kind of stopping all that, a deep trusting this life, deep trusting of the moment, just trusting. So the trust is so deep that we don't even say, I trust. There's no I to trust. I is just one more about, you know, it just trusts, it just float. And then reality, in a certain kind of way, holds us up. So there's a stopping and ending of the aboutness, ending of the desire and the drive and the compulsion to always be thinking and measuring and planning and figuring and remembering, and something gets put to rest. Something gets released and stops. And to have that experience of that possibility shows us something that many people have never known. And it doesn't negate the world that we come back to, the world of concerns and thoughts and plans and all that. It can be a fine world to live in, but it really helps if you live in it, if you realize it's not the only game in town. There's this other game of putting it all down and taking a vacation. The Buddha called it a profound rest, or profound kind of security and safety that's found in putting all this down. So, I would like to read a couple of passages from the ancient texts, a few passages about how people who report describe their own experience of doing that. And so one is from a nun in an ancient collection of verses by the female disciples of the Buddha, by a nun named Uttama. And she wrote, "In accord with what the Buddha taught, I have cultivated all seven factors of awakening, the path for attaining Nibbana, Nirvana. I obtained emptiness and signlessness. It is what I wished for. I am now a true daughter of the Buddha, always delighting in Nibbana." Always delighting in Nibbana. So one of the questions is, what is Nibbana? And why would one delight in it? How is it delighting? But whatever it is, here's someone who's attained awakening, and which is a profound letting go, flipping over and floating. And she finds it delightful. It's kind of nice to know. The second quote I wanted to read is from the Buddha, where he describes people who have attained liberation. Not clinging, they, the ones who are liberated, not clinging, they are freed through the end of birth and death. Happy, attaining safety, they are released here and now. They've gone beyond all fear and hate. They have gone beyond all suffering. And it's there, so it's here, it says also they're happy. Isn't that nice? I like it. Because this experience of release, or putting everything down, or floating, or stepping into the silence, some people are afraid that it leaves us a blank, leaves us as a kind of a blank thing, nothing, nobody. You know, then you can't enjoy life, you can't do anything, and you know, it's like, you know, what then? But in both these quotes, there's delight and happiness. It's a wonderful thing to be happy. And if you remember the talk earlier about how, you know, the path to awakening flowing down the mountain outside, where there's a lot of practices of letting go, letting go, letting go, all the practices that have to do with letting go or abstaining or abandoning are all associated with some kind of happiness. In the Buddhist tradition, letting go in some deep way, or even in a shallow way, letting go, is associated with happiness, with joy. It's kind of a remarkable thing, because I think many people, that's counterintuitive, that that's the case. And then I wanted to read a poem by from the ancient collection of verses by the male disciples of the Buddha, the Theragata. And this monk, he writes, says, and is also a man who's, you know, a person who's fully awakened. And he describes himself this way: "I am a friend to all, a helper to all. I am sympathetic to all beings. I develop mindfulness of loving kindness, and I delight in harmlessness. I gladden my mind. I make it immovable and unshakable. I develop the Brahmaviharas, not cultivated by hostile people." Pretty good. That's what's waiting for us when we get liberated. That we become a friend to all, a helper to all, sympathetic to all beings. And we cultivate the opposite of hostility. So So one of the ways of understanding the goal of the path to liberation is to have the our capacity or movement of letting go to become ever deeper or ever fuller or ever more thoroughgoing. So the letting go leaves us with nothing that we cling to, nothing that we hold on to, nothing that we, are preoccupied with. We can still be occupied with things, but preoccupied means there's no freedom with what we're, our thoughts and ideas and what's going on. And this idea of letting go, in the ultimate form, takes the form, can be translated into English as release. And the word release is how I translate nibbana, the word nirvana. And the advantage of translating as release is that it associates it with all the other practices having to do with letting go that are part of the path of practice. Letting go of unethical behavior, letting go of our attachments to the sense objects, abandoning the hindrances, letting go of contentment. Well, if you really want to be content, let go of that too. But letting go of discontent. And so this letting go, and so that movement of letting go, one form or other, with one, maybe slightly different shades of exactly how it's done or how it's understood, is the kind of the movement of practice. And what's really nice is that as practice deepens, there's an increasing sense of satisfaction, rightness, pleasure in the less and less we cling to anything, the less we hold on. The less the mind is about things, the less the mind is involved in thinking about things, and just kind of this quieting and stilling and settling and profound trusting the moment. Trusting so much we don't need to think about things anymore. Trusting the moment so much that we don't need to be planning ahead, measuring what's happening, thinking about what it means for me, myself, and mine. Having this vacation, having this stilling, letting the mind move into the silence, where there's no music in a sense, or flipping over and floating. So that it's so satisfying that yes, why there's no resistance anymore, no hesitation to allow the mind to let go fully enough to come to a profound peace, profound rest, so the mind can really let go. One of the things it lets go of is self-preoccupation, self-identity, self-referencing, self-construction, being self-apologetic, being self-defensive, being self-assertive. But to stop all the selfing, to put it down to rest, to release ourselves from needing to be anything, any self, is such a good vacation, is such a good sense of peace. It feels so good to finally do this great thing. And then if it's appropriate and interesting, and we can always, it's always available for us to pick up again. You're not going to lose anything that's really is important and what you need in life. You can pick it up again. So Nibbana is a profound release. It's a continued letting go. And it's not so obvious when you read some of the suttas in English, because it's fairly common to translate Nibbana, actually, to not translate it, but to keep it in the original, or try to. But it turns out, if you look at the most common English translations of the suttas, like the ones by Bhikkhu Bodhi, he has the word Nibbana, which is a noun, sprinkled all over his translations, where the original doesn't have it. So if you read the English, you think the Buddha is talking about this thing, this noun. Some people think of it as a place. Some people think of Nibbana as this kind of transcendental reality, transcendent reality, partly because we keep reading it as a thing, a noun. But more often than not, Bhikkhu Bodhi is not translating a noun as Nibbana, he's translating a verb. And the verb is Nibbayati, which, if you wanted to be literal into English but still use Nibbana as kind of the translation, you would have to translate it as Nibbanized. The person was Nibbanized. And instead of saying Nibbanized, Bhikkhu Bodhi says the person attains Nibbana. And it's kind of dangerous to use the word attain, because attain is kind of close to having, getting. We all want attainments. And spiritual attainments are like, you know, that's like the gold standard for spiritual materialism. You know, the more attainments you can have, it's like more badges, more, you know, brownie points you get, and, you know, it's just, attainments are like so important for our status in life. So to get something. So we attain, we get this thing called Nibbana. But it doesn't say, the word attainment is not there at all in the text there. It's a verb, Nibbanized. So in order to get around that, what I like to translate both Nibbana as release, and the verb as released. The person attains release, or the person is released. The person releases their attachments. And there's a wonderful, for me, and it's my translation, so that's suspicious. That Lee read from, you know, from my translation of the Book of Eights. There's three little words. I almost wanted to be the title of the book. Release is peace. So in my little mind, that's fun to say. Release is peace. It's a nice slogan. It could be a bumper sticker. Release is peace. So this idea of that the releasing, the letting go. And so the operating thing is the action. So Nibbayati is an action, and Nibbana is an action noun, and refers to an activity, an action, not a place you go. And the action is the action of releasing, of letting go. The Buddha said, how is Nibbana directly visible, immediate, inviting one to come and see, applicable to be personally experienced by the wise? So how is it directly visible and immediate? In abandoning lust or hatred or delusion, one does not intend for one's own affliction, for the affliction of others, or for the affliction of both, and one does not experience mental suffering and dejection. This is how Nibbana is visible. This, you know, is this okay with you guys, that it's not some great spiritual reality and cosmic consciousness or transcendent reality, and it's not described in terms of some kind of phenomenal, out of this world bliss that you can go home to your friends and colleagues and say, look what I attained. I mean, it's like, this was like the best ever. Wow, you know, this was so good. This was like, you know, like that restaurant I ate, but the food was the best in the world. That was so good. I went to IRC and I had the best, you know. I had the best abandoning of lust ever. And I had the best abandoning of hatred. And in doing that, I did not intend to harm anyone. And I had no suffering, no dejection. There was a time in the Buddha, there was a person who had been a monk who was so disappointed in the Buddha because the Buddha had didn't display any magical or psychic powers for him. So he didn't think the Buddha was up to anything good. And so he disrobed, he went into town, and he started criticizing the Buddha to everyone who would listen to him. And he said, "That Buddha, you know, all he teaches is the end of suffering." Yeah. This is one of, I don't know if you know this, but this maybe is one of the reasons why we're in the Theravadin Buddhist tradition. There's a long historical reason that Theravada is called the little vehicle. Just the ending of suffering. Oh well. You know, if you can't get anything to get it better, then you know, you can settle for that. So it's, you know, it's almost psychological. It's almost like something that you could understand, at least in principle, the end of lust, the end of hate, hostility. And then right after the Buddha's awakening, he thought to himself, he described to himself what had just happened, what this state was like, what this experience was like. "It is the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all attachments, the destruction of craving. It is fading away, cessation, Nibbana." So it's a series of kind of more or less synonyms. And what I want to highlight in reading this is these verbs: stilling, quieting down. Formations means quieting down of all the mental activity. Relinquishing of all attachments. The verb is to relinquish. So stilling, relinquishing. And then the word destruction or ending. It's kind of a little bit more on the dramatic scale, on the range of letting go. But it's the ending of something. And then fading away. The fading away of attachment, the fading away of being caught up. And then cessation. Cessation's also the something comes to an end. And cessation is also points to the actual moments of by when something ceases. Once it's ceased, then it's just not there anymore. So cessation is part of that movement of letting go. So in a way, there's five different words that point to some movement of when something comes to an end, when something is released or let go. And then the sixth word is Nibbana. So the suggestion is that Nibbana, as a kind of a near synonym of all the others, Nibbana also is, what's being emphasized, is a kind of release. It's not a thing. It's not a place. It's not a particular state. Like, you know, the jhanas are states. But Nibbana is not a state in the same way. It's describing the movement of release, of freedom. And in doing that, the kind of the other side of that release is absence, a radical absence, absence of clinging. And the Theravadin Buddhist tradition, down through the centuries, became very uncomfortable with that absence. Because if Nibbana is like the ultimate goal of the whole religion, it can't be nothing. I mean, you know, what do you say to your neighbors, you know, who like neighbor religions? You know, like they have, you know, they have great ultimates. And again, what do you have in your little vehicle? Nothing. It doesn't go over very well. It doesn't, you know, encourage people to come and practice. And why should I do this hard work of liberation? You know, it's a lot of work to come on retreat. And, you know, and if we had advertised the retreat, come to a one-week retreat at IRC, and we're aiming to get you nothing. We're hoping that the result is nothing. You know, you probably wouldn't come. But it's a little bit hard to understand that nothing is important. But this nothing is like, it can be the most, for some people, the most important nothing in their lives. Yes, it's nothing, but it's the absence of suffering. It's absence of all the forces and contractions of suffering. It's the turning over and floating. It's hearing the silence for the first time. The refrigerator has been on for 50 years. And finally the humming stops. What? You didn't even realize it was on until it stopped. So this Nibbana, this release, kind of leaves us with nothing, but it's the most important nothing in some people's lives. And now we know something, and we know a possibility. We know what the practice is about. The practice is not about being nothing or disappearing or having, you know, being some kind of blank. It's the practice is to not cling, to let go of the clinging. And you're not left with nothing in the end. You're left with happiness. You're left with delight. And the word that the Buddha most commonly used for this in the Book of Eights, you're left with peace, profound peace. And that peace is something that then you can live your life with and can walk through your life with a sense of ease, a sense of peace. And we do lose some things in that process. And as we hope to lose some things. And one of the great things to lose, to leave behind, and hope that it never comes back, is having confidence in greed, hate, and delusion. Having confidence in clinging, craving, and having confidence in fear. Certain kinds of fear are good to have, healthy to have. But, you know, modern psychologists differentiate between fear and anxiety. And I think most people, when they talk about fear, are talking about anxiety. And anxiety is something more deeply embedded that we carry with us, even when situations around us are relatively safe. It's you know, has to do with our memory and our experiences and our imagination, our conditioning. And some people have a lot of confidence in their fear. And they wouldn't talk that way. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, if anything, it just doesn't occur to them that they can have confidence in fear. But if an anthropologist from Mars came to study and made conclusions based on what people do the most, some of these people, boy, they really believe in it. There must be a religion of fear, religion of desire, religion of being egomaniac that we see sometimes in the public world. So we're hoping for some change, that the release, the letting go, does kind of allow for something to shift and change. But that can take a little bit of reflection, a little bit of appreciation of what's happened, recognizing what's been put down, and then beginning to kind of put a question mark after it when it comes back. So on a retreat like this, there were definitely things, I would say, that all of us put down. All of us got quiet about some things, some preoccupations we carry with us in our life, probably kind of settled down after a few days enough to experience some little different way of being. Maybe wasn't dramatic, but, you know, there's some things that normally you're caught up in that maybe quieted down. And that's valuable. That's part of this whole kind of, it's kind of like an aspect of, or a taste of, or a dimension of Nibbana, in that Nibbana is release and letting go. And if you can kind of appreciate the absence, understand what you put down temporarily. And sometimes we really understand it well when it comes back. That, you know, some people are surprised at the end of the retreat that their personality returns. And they're not ready for it. So we see clearly the idea is to everything, always be mindful. Oh, look, this has come back. Now there's the absence. It's gone. Now it's come back. Let it register, because that registering, seeing, and recognizing the value of it lets the value of it sink in deeper. It becomes kind of a conditioning. Oh, this is valuable. I've known people who've had some very good releasing, letting go, dropping things that, you know, were troubling them a lot. And they didn't recognize it. They didn't know how to see it. They didn't know it was valuable. And the story that I like to tell, I apologize, those have heard this a number of times, was when I was teaching many years ago at a kind of a convent in San Rafael called Santa Sabina. And there was a meditation hall we used, a big room we used for meditation hall, lots of windows. And it was November. And so it was kind of the fall, kind of clear, crisp air and blue skies. And at the 10 o'clock meditation that morning, there's this beautiful light coming into the meditation hall, and it was kind of like beautifully still, like a still lake, quiet and peaceful. And everyone sat so still. It was like magic. And there was such deep tranquility and peace in the room. And, you know, I felt like this is, everyone's having this. It felt magical. It was quite something. And right after that, since I was a teacher, I had a meeting with one of the students, and we meet in this beautiful, for me, because of my kind of preferences, little monastic cell. and I sat in my wooden chair, so she sat in her wooden chair, and she came in, and it was like very kind of me. It was, you know, I could almost not speak. It was, I still felt this deep tranquility and peace. And she came in. And it was obvious that she had the same thing. Peaceful, deep, tranquil. And we just sat there. It was like this, there was light in the room, light shining, you know. It was pretty special. And it was even more special because I'd known her for a number of years. And this is a person who had a lot of troubles, a lot of kind of racked with inner turmoil and challenges and anxieties and angers and, you know, trauma in her life, and she's, you know, it's a lot of self-criticism and self-loathing and all kinds of, you know, that's mostly what we talked about all these years. And so she came in and she was so, I never seen her this way. And so, you know, I guess I said, maybe, how are you? And she said, oh, it's pretty good. And then she said, but yesterday, it wasn't this way. Yesterday, I was all caught up and consumed and angry. And as she told me about yesterday, it was like she morphed and changed in front of me into someone who was miserable. And I thought, oh no. why don't you leave yesterday in yesterday? Why do you have to bring yesterday into today, given what she had? It's because she didn't understand the value of what she was having. She didn't see there was something she could nourish and drink and take in and help her be reconditioned, be kind of in a loving, beautiful way by reality. But she had confidence in her misery, confidence in what happened yesterday enough that she really wanted to bring it forth. So there is a kind of, you know, a loss of being confident in certain things and then a gain in confidence in other things. And part of the gain is to have confidence in letting go. Confidence that we don't have to always be holding on, craving, being hostile. There's protection, there's safety, there's wisdom to be found in letting go, in release. And this release, the Buddha called the greatest bliss. Nibbana is the greatest bliss, he said. Release is peace. And then, you know, there's part of this is to understand how nothing in our experience is self. So that, you know, which is nice, kind of freedom. Here are some of the words that the Buddha used to describe those people who have realized that there's nothing in our experience that can be self. They're great heroes, victors in the world. Sometimes they're called great nagas. Nagas is either a great elephant or a powerful serpent. So, you know, it's a little bit, you know, cognitive dissonance for many people in the West who hear the teaching of not self as a total teaching of self-effacement. You're not supposed to count. You know, you can't assert yourself. But they're, you know, great victors, great heroes. So I wanted to end with a very interesting test. I'm not going to test you, but, you know, it wouldn't be a bad idea, right? End of a retreat, just test them, make sure. And then they know at the beginning of the retreat that we're going to test them at the end, the exam's going to come. Yeah, I bet they would kind of, like, you know, work a little bit harder. Yeah, yeah. So this is the test for arhatship. It's a test to find out if you're fully enlightened, fully awakened. So Lee's not going to take down notes on how you answer this, how well you do. But so this is what, if someone says that they're fully awakened, these are the questions you can ask them. And then, fortunately or unfortunately, the text gives us the right answers. So, you know, hopefully if you ask someone, they haven't read the text and they're talking from experience, but I'll give you the answers. So the first question is, how does one know and see what is seen, heard, sensed, and cognized so that through non-clinging, one's mind is liberated from all the afflictions? And those are the four things that Lee talked about yesterday that had to do with Bahia, the seen, heard, sensed, and cognized. So how does one know and see? So here's the answer. By knowing all of these, the seen, the heard, the sensed, the cognized, by knowing all of these while abiding independent, detached, free, and without being attracted or repelled. So if they answer that way, then they've answered correctly for one of the five necessary questions. The second question you should ask them, how does one know and see the five aggregates so that through non-clinging, one's mind is liberated from all the afflictions? By knowing that each aggregate, each of the aggregates are the five psychophysical processes by which we respond and react to the world. So the Buddha puts them into five lumps, five different categories, these the ways we kind of operate and relate to the world. And by knowing that these aggregates, that each aggregate, each of these processes, is feeble, fading away, does not provide comfort, and by knowing the fading away and cessation, giving up and relinquishment of attraction and clinging towards these aggregates, then one understands one is liberated. So a person can say that one understands the impermanence of the aggregates, the unreliability of them, and has seen that they fade away, that they come and they go, the release from them, the stopping of them. That's the second right answer. The third question, how does one know and see the six elements of earth, water, fire, air, space, and consciousness so that through non-clinging, one's mind is liberated from the afflictions? By knowing each element as not self, with not creating a self based on the elements. Question four. How does one know and see the six senses and the six sense experiences we have on them? How do we see the world of the senses, sense experience, so that through non-clinging, one's mind is liberated from affliction? With the destruction, fading away, cessation, giving up, and relinquishing of desire, lust, craving, attraction, and clinging, and the fading away, cessation, giving up of all mental standpoints, adherences, and underlying tendencies in regard to sense experience, then one is liberated. And the last one, how does one know in relationship to one's body and consciousness that eye-making, mind-making, and the underlying tendency to conceit have been eradicated? The answer, by seeing the arising and passing, the arising and ceasing of all experience of suffering through practicing the jhanas, the deep stability, the deep purpose of deep concentration is ultimately to be able to see the arising and passing, the arising and ceasing of phenomena. And there's something about seeing the comings and going, the appearing and disappearing of things, which is a medicine, is an antidote to being caught up in me-making and I-making and conceit. And so someone who's fully liberated has seen that, and it helps them to see through this whole self project, what it's all about. So what's noteworthy with each question and answer, they all concern ordinary empirical experience. Nothing is said about rebirth, past lives, ontological statements about transcendent spheres of experience, nor is there any any questioning about doctrinal claims. The repeated concern is how one can know and see, so one is liberated from all afflictions. The pragmatic, human, ordinary world that we live in, that's where we find release, we find freedom. It's in this world, it's the world we live in, the world we'll return to tomorrow. It's the world that we find ourselves in always. If we can begin seeing the movement of release, of letting go, of fading away, of turning over and floating, and allowing things to kind of support us. If we can take time to experience that profound silence, so that when we come back to the music, we always know the silence is here. The release that shows us a capacity for peace, a capacity for happiness, that maybe is always here, always available, and profoundly trustable, profoundly beneficial. That's the wellspring for how we can live in the world with wisdom and compassion, so that we can take the instructions of the Buddha to heart. When he said, I am free of all entanglements, both divine and human. Now, speaking to a group of his disciples, now you are free from all entanglements. So, go forth for the good of the many, for the happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the welfare and the good and the happiness of gods and humans. So when people in his presence became profoundly released, freed, their next instruction, their final instruction, was to go out for the welfare and happiness of the world. Tomorrow, may you go out for the welfare and happiness of the world that waits for you. You have a lot to offer. So, thank you.